Welcome to episode 286 of the Microsoft Cloud IT Pro Podcast, recorded live on May 27th, 2022. This is a show about Microsoft 365 and Azure from the perspective of IT pros and end users, where we discuss the topic or recent news and how it relates to you. Build has come and gone, and while there wasn't a ton of announcements relevant to IT pros, we have managed to scrape together a few. So, what did we find interesting? We start off with a pre-build news item with Azure DNS Private Resolver. From there, we move into Microsoft starting to enable security defaults in Azure AD for everyone, as well as a new preview feature to remove inactive users in Azure AD. From there, we try to sort out Microsoft DevBox, collaboration controls in Power Apps, and Microsoft Power Pages. The event has commenced.
Now you've done it.
I've commenced an event.
You've commenced something.
I have commenced wrapping up build. I had no transition there. I could not get from commenced to build in any way, shape, or form.
I've commenced making fun of build.
We got to get you to work on this transition thing.
You'll get there somehow.
Talking about build announcement for my broken OneDrive or Mac. I feel like there was something else I was going to bring up too, but I can't remember what it is now.
I can't help you there. It's your memory.
Unfortunately, or it's my memory that seems to be leaving me. Getting old. Someone told me that the other day. Someone else. See, it's my memory again. Something about as you get old, your memory goes.
Oh, boy. All right. So I got to get you back on track.
Okay. So did build you actually watch any of Build? Did you watch any of it?
I did. I watched the keynote with Satya and friends, and I caught up on a couple of sessions afterwards. I think it's kind of light on IT pro content, but I was trying to catch up a little bit on anything around Arc or Kubernetes and some of the web app stuff as well. So I think I've been a little kind of off the beaten path when it comes to Azure web apps versus container apps and kind of all these different services that are out there and how to play around with. So I've been trying to wrap my head around all that.
Got it. I am proud of you. I did not watch any of Build. I had great intentions, but I have some vacation coming up and vacation and build and the amount of work I have to get done before vacation did not align very well in a way that was accommodating to spending much time watching build. So I have been mainly catching up on blog posts to catch up on build news this year and watching Twitter.
Yeah, that is a thing that you can do as well. You know, if you're catching up on things, a good way to do it is the Book of News. So I'm not sure if you saw, but there was a build Book of News again for this one. It's something that Microsoft has been doing with all these kind of larger events. It's a dedicated site to all the news and announcements that come out of events like this. So Ignite, Build, I don't think they do like a Book of News for Inspire or anything like that, or some of like the smaller partner-driven conferences. Maybe they should, but you can totally go through the Book of News. It's very much, you and I have been through this before as we do the kind of media pass things with the Microsoft folks and the marketing teams that run things.
Yep.
For those who have never done it, Microsoft publishes this Book of News ahead of time. It's built out before the show goes on. So you have an opportunity either as internals to write up all your announcements and as maybe media or folks who you want to get word out to early under NDA, you'll get access to the Book of News, which is the same exact thing that now you have access to kind of post-event. The problem with that is all the blog posts are usually hidden and they're behind like randomized AKMS URLs. And those don't always get cleaned up by the time the Book of News lands. So you do have to kind of be mindful of that there might be some dead links and you might have to do some Google, Bing, DuckDuckGo kind of thing if you want to, you know, be able to find the details about anything.
Yeah, it does. And I always like it, to your point, there's usually not a lot of details in it. It's like one paragraph about each announcement, but it does give you that good overview of. I would also say that it's most things that are announced. We have also tended to find that bigger announcements don't always make it into the book of news. Like, Microsoft still wants to keep some things secret up until the day of the conference. So even as media, when we get the book of news earlier, there are sometimes some of those larger announcements that are just missing from it, and you don't find out until the day of the show. So even going back and looking through it after the fact, if you don't see something or you're like, wow, there was a big announcement that's not in there, there may have been an announcement or two that didn't make it in there as well.
Yeah, you know, there's also the things that come out beforehand. I don't think we've talked about this one yet, but, you know, you can watch in the lead up to shows as well. Like, there's not always enough room to get everything in. There are some services that are announced ahead of time or enhancements to existing services. So, what, about 2 weeks in a, 2 weeks ago now, Azure Private DNS Resolver was announced. Like, that's really cool and kind of big, but really not a part of build or anything like that. Really, it's effectively like an iterative kind of service change, and hey, it's pushed out the door, and you hopefully hear about it, but if you didn't hear about it, then I don't know what to tell you.
So what is the private DNS resolver, Scott?
What is the private DNS resolver? So if you're familiar with Azure DNS, Azure DNS is a service that allows you to, up until this point, before private resolver was around, allowed you to create things like A records for anything that you wanted within your Azure environment. And you could manage your DNS that well and kind of delegate it over to it. And now really, like, that effectively becomes Azure Public DNS. And now you have this preview of Azure Private DNS Resolver. And that's going to give you a private DNS service for your virtual networks. So you can go ahead and manage and resolve domain names within your virtual networks without the need to stand up any other custom DNS solution. Like, you don't need to stand up a Windows DNS server, bind, or anything like that. So this lets you use your custom domain names instead of the Azure provided domain names during deployment, which is kind of nice to have, right? Like, it's just less infrastructure. It's less operational overhead. There's no need to stand up any type of IaaS-based solution and maintain that server, kind of babysit the compute that comes along with it. Think about how you architect a highly available DNS service, anything like that. And because it's built into Azure and it's natively part of your virtual network, it understands the SDN and everything else that's there. So it just works out of the box with ExpressRoute. It works with site-to-site VPNs, point-to-site VPNs, Azure Bastion, all that kind of stuff. They can use this as well for resolution, which is pretty cool. Should give you a cost reduction because you're not running those traditional IaaS server kind of based solutions anymore. You know, you might have been able to get away with that a little cheap if you were only running one, but most of us want things like high availability, resiliency, backup, all that kind of jazz on a service like DNS. So to make that happen, it took a little bit of architecting and it certainly cost a little bit of money to get that going. So it's just effectively an extension of existing Azure Public DNS. It's fully available, cross AZ, like it's a regional service kind of thing. You have the advantages of the entire regional network that you're a part of. So that thing means you still get things like very low round trip latencies within region. Like, you're talking like less than 2 milliseconds on the high end for any type of resolution. And the cool thing is, now that it's just built into Azure, like, if you were thinking about like, hey, I'm doing, say, deployment through Terraform or through Azure DevOps, something like that, and as part of my deployment, I need to stand up a new A record as a part of that. Well, now there's just an API that's available to you. You can use like the REST API, just straight ARM, anything like that, or like an ARM template or Bicep, things like that, and just go ahead and deploy and kind of have that management and automation plane available to you.
Got it. Nice. So I did notice, I was looking through this too, because I was curious, it is only available in certain regions yet.
It is in preview. Yeah, keep that in mind.
Yeah. It's only in like West US 3, East US and East US 2, so it's not West US and West US 2. And because this is specific to a VNet, it does have to live in the same region as your VNet. So you may or may not be able to use this yet based on where your VNet is that you want to try it out with. I'm assuming you could always do like some peered VNets if you really wanted to try this out and you weren't in a region, you could do some peering and do some stuff there. But yeah, that is going to be one of those restrictions that you're going to want to pay attention to, is it does have limited regional availability and there is that dependency on the same region as your VNet.
Yeah, preview, right? Comes with all those usual caveats.
Exactly. A few other restrictions too, like some nets on minimum of a /28 or maximum of /24. You can't have multiple resolvers on the same DNet or VNet, which I mean, I guess kind of makes sense. I don't know that I'd want two separate DNS services on the same VNet anyways.
Things start to get a little confusing.
Right? No IPv6 yet in public preview. So go check out the documentation. We'll post some links to go read this in the show notes, or it's in our Discord chat as well for those of you that are paying attention there.
Indeed.
What else?
You tell me, what else?
I want to talk about this one primarily because I think it's going to catch people off guard and people need to be aware of it. Is, I don't know if this was specifically a build announcement or if this just kind of correlated with build, but there was an article published about raising the baseline security for all organizations in the world. I mean, that's pretty broad sweeping, all organizations in the world. But what raising baseline security for all organizations in the world means is that security defaults are going to start rolling out across, I think it's all the tenants. So security defaults were announced, I don't know, a year or so ago, maybe a year and a half ago. Maybe even a couple of years ago, but
yeah, it's been a while now. COVID times.
October 2019 was a key date because tenants created before October of 2019 were not included in security defaults with it enabled by default. So those security defaults were deployed, but they were left off by default. Tenants created after October 2019, so newer tenants after security defaults were in place, security defaults were on by default, and you could still go in and turn them off if you didn't want them. What was announced is that the rollout is going to start for all of the tenants. So this is going to roll out to approximately, give or take, 60 million accounts over the course of the next, and I don't know if they actually gave a timeline of how long this is going to take, but it's going to start rolling out. You as global admins are going to have the option to opt into them right away when they're deployed, or you can snooze the security defaults for as many as 14 days. And then after that, you're going to have to go set it up. So if you have an older tenant, if you have not looked at security defaults, if you have left them off because you don't want to use security defaults, within the next several, I would say the next couple months, several months or so, you're going to have to start making a decision of, are you okay with security defaults? You're going to have to start prepping your users for what security defaults means, or you're going to have to leverage conditional access for MFA, I think, and I was just looking for it in this article. I did not prep this article well. If you're using conditional access, you can still turn it off, or maybe once it's enabled, you'll be able to go in and disable it again.
So something to keep in mind is security defaults are a default thing. They'll kind of be on by default, but you can still opt out of them. And that's not changing either. So if you fall into the cohort of customers who doesn't want to use MFA for your users, you don't want to leverage things like conditional access, like, you know, basically you want to sign the dotted line and say, I understand hand and accept all the risks associated with not using this thing, then you can go ahead and disable that. There's just basically a blade for the property of security defaults, yes or no, like on or off in the Azure portal. So that's available directly through like Azure Active Directory properties or through the admin center. And that's it. I think, you know, the preference, security defaults on for everybody, is that you go ahead and use this. But you might have a very good reason not to. I don't know what that is, but you might have a good reason not to.
Right. I can't figure out from this article too, like they're going to turn it on. Is it going to hit everybody? And if you want to re-opt out, you're going to have to re-opt out?
Yes.
So you may have a day where it just shows up and everybody starts getting prompted. And then you're going to have to go turn it off.
Oh, no, no. I guess I misunderstood your question. Like, you can go in and explicitly turn it off and, like, opt out ahead of time.
Got it.
So by you saying no ahead of time, you're effectively saying, like, I don't want to be yes.
I don't
or
want
while
yes.
you're in there, you could click the button and go yes and just opt in early, and that'd be fine. But if you don't explicitly click no, you're going to be opted in.
So they must have some telemetry in the background. So I guess this is the scenario I'm thinking of. If I'm no already because Microsoft hasn't forced it and I want to stay no, how do I stay no instead of having that flipped on to be enabled automatically?
Just go spam the no button. That's all.
Just toggle no.
Save. Done.
That was the scenario I was thinking of, is how does Microsoft know that I explicitly turned it off or don't want it versus it's just off because it was never on because I'm on an old tenant?
You just spam the button. You'll be fine.
All right. But yes, I actually have it off in mind because I do use conditional access. That would be my biggest thing, is I would tend to recommend, if you're not using conditional access, that security defaults is probably something you want. It's going to enforce MFA. It's going to block basic authentication. It's going to force everybody to use modern auth. There's like five or six different things that security defaults does. You can accomplish all the same thing with conditional access, but have more control over it. So I am a big fan of conditional access instead of security defaults. But if you're not going to do conditional access, if you're on, you don't want to pay for it, I think security defaults is usually a good thing.
I was going to say, some of this depends on your licensing as well.
Yes.
And, you know, you want the bells and whistles, you got to pay for it. So I think that's kind of the biggest limitation with security defaults. Like, they're a good logical set of defaults, but if you've been doing this a while, like, you immediately jump to the next step and you go like, all right, conditional access makes more sense for me because I can do this, this, and this with this level of granularity. And at that point, you're already somebody who knows you need to pay for a little bit more.
Yep, absolutely.
Do you feel overwhelmed by trying to manage your Office 365 environment? Are you facing unexpected issues that disrupt your company's productivity? IntelliJink is here to help. Much like you take your car to the mechanic that has specialized knowledge on how to best keep your car running, IntelliJink helps you with your Microsoft Cloud environment because that's their expertise. IntelliJink keeps up with the latest updates in the Microsoft Cloud to help keep your business running smoothly and ahead of the curve. Whether you are a small organization with just a few users up to an organization of several thousand employees, they want to partner with you to implement and administer your Microsoft Cloud technology. Visit them at IntelliJink.com/podcast. That's IntelliJink.com/podcast for more information or to schedule a 30-minute call to get started with them today. Remember, IntelliJink focuses on the Microsoft Cloud so you can focus on your business.
So that was mine. What's your next one? Or can I stay in Azure AD land?
Oh, you can stay in
Azure
AD
land. Will you let me stay in Azure AD land? So
sure.
This is another new one that has hit public preview. This one is also one that requires some licensing because it is a part of Azure Active Directory identity governance. But there is a new feature rolling out within access reviews and identity governance that will automatically allow you to review and remove inactive users in Azure Active Directory. And based on an earlier article, you can also do this. I'll have to go find that to add it to the show notes. This also will be for guest users as well as current users. So I know with Azure AD, that
my Azure AD has had this problem of inviting guest users, of having users that I create in Azure Active Directory, all of that. They leave, they don't need guest access anymore. And I just never go in and manually make the effort to clean them up. This is going to help with that, both for guest accounts, for inactive users, in terms of forcing you to go through, review them, and then help remove, clean up Azure AD from those old inactive users within your Azure AD environment.
Yeah. Just keep in mind that this isn't some like new experience that you've got to go through. It's built on top of the existing access review mechanism that's available within Azure AD today. So that is all sitting out there for you. And like, it's probably a good call out again, like we talked about with conditional access, like you might want to go down this path because you're a little bit more savvy and you have licensing for it, all those kinds of things. Access reviews also require licensing, specifically Azure AD Premium P2s.
Yeah, I am going to reserve the right to disagree with Microsoft making, I would say access reviews, I'm okay. If you want to do the access reviews as a P2 license and build in some of that functionality around actually going through review process, okay. I would argue that this is one, I would, not the access reviews, but being able to easily expire inactive users, even if it's just, I want to set a policy to automatically delete any user that hasn't logged in for 12 months. Don't worry about the reviews. Don't worry about the workflow behind it. Just set a rule like that. I think that should be a default Azure functionality. Just from a security perspective is my thought.
I can see both sides of it. Like one is, you know, I think lots of us tend to look at it through the lens of this is a simple thing. And the reality is, like, there's all this bolted on process with access reviews. Like, who does the access reviews? How long do the access reviews go on for? There's a dedicated portal to go in and action those action reviews. Yep. And the flip side of it is, like, maybe in your scenario, like you said, you only want to tombstone users who have been active for 12 months. And, like, that's the rule. And if you do that, you might not need access reviews. Like if that's just administrative policy, that's probably something that you, as a savvy user who knows you want it, like a savvy admin, you'll go and just script it out and run it on a schedule, right? You could do that through Azure Automation or any kind of like automation engine you wanted to. It could be a script that runs in your desktop and like goes ahead and does what it needs to do. Like you just have a calendar alert that pops up. Is it the most ideal situation? No. But I think if you look at like access reviews, they're not focusing so much on like the like scriptability automation component of it. They're focusing on the human side of access reviews. And when you focus on the human side of it, like, yeah, you're going to have to pay for the humans that want to do that. They haven't taken away the ability for you to do the simple actions via API, and all that stuff still exists. Like, should there be a nice, easy, like, scriptable cron engine within M365? Maybe, like that'd be kind of cool, right? If it was there, like, hey, give me like the shortcuts of like Microsoft 365 or like the Zapier of it, right? Just drop this here, do this, and go ahead and run it for me in like a serverless fashion on a schedule. Yeah, but they'll probably make you pay for that service too if it ever comes.
Probably. There's some comments in Discord too about Torek does the script. He has an automated script, runs it every 6 months to delete those stale guest accounts. He also said he will share if anybody is interested. But you've got to come join Discord to talk to Torek then, or get him to share it publicly. But
I'm going to encourage him to put it on GitHub and we'll share a link.
And we'll share a link there. There you go. But no, that's my solution to your point and similar to what Torek does. Like if I just want to bulk do it, I don't care about the access review process. I'm just going to do it with a script. I just think it would be a handy functionality, especially for like small businesses, smaller organizations that maybe don't necessarily have that scripting expertise, to not have the full-blown access review, but just a simple, like you said, a simple cron job or a simple toggle of
just automatically delete guest accounts that are older than X days.
Hey, ISV idea, right?
It is. There you go. This is the one
that'll make you your millions.
I mean, in theory, a couple of connectors and Flow, you could do the same thing, right? Like, go spin through all my users in Azure AD, look for ones that haven't logged in so many years and delete them.
Don't give away all your secrets. Don't tell them how you're going to do it. Don't.
Is 51 lines small?
Yes.
I would say 50 lines is a small script. Most of my scripts are longer than 51 lines.
Yeah. At 51 lines, it's something that documents itself. It's magical. It's self-documenting. All set, ready to go.
Yes. So that is a new one coming. If you're interested in the access review portion of stale accounts or of guest accounts, that functionality is, I think both of those are out in preview now. And there are two different ones. Was one for guest accounts and one for stale accounts, I believe. But we will have links to those in the show notes as well.
Yes. Yeah. Let's stay on the weirdness that is this cross between Azure and kind of Office 365 and the things that are going on there. And I solidly put things like access reviews in there, right? Because it's a shared identity system and everything.
Yep.
Tell me what you think about DevBox. Have you heard of this Microsoft DevBox offering? Because I'm a little confused.
I have. I'm confused as well. So DevBox. If you go read the articles and look at certain screenshots, it will confuse you even more. Microsoft's description of Microsoft DevBox is, and I quote, a new cloud service that provides developers with secure, ready-to-code developer workstations for hybrid teams of any size. Microsoft DevBox empowers developers to focus on the code they can write, and then it goes on and so forth. It leverages Windows 365 to integrate DevBoxes with Intune, Microsoft Endpoint Manager, and then it continues on. My understanding, based on what a DevBox is a custom image of a virtual machine that you can create and assign to developers so that they can go spin up or connect to a DevBox that is pre-configured with all of their development tools based on what they need to do. I am failing to see how this is new because you can do this today with Windows 365 and Azure AD. Because I combed through a bunch of the documentation and my initial thought was, okay, this would be really cool if I could say, I want a DevBox and it's built on top of Windows 365 and it gives me like a checklist. I want to auto install Visual Studio. I want to maybe have IIS installed. Maybe I want to run a script or something. I don't know, some type of pick list to make it easier to set up to give to your users, but it literally sounds like it's just a custom deployed or a custom built VHD that you have to create, you have to upload, create this image, and then you just assign it to developers through this DevBox portal. And some of the UIs, like, then again, this it's in private preview. So we haven't been able to get our hands on it or see it, but it gives you like projects and then different an interface. So it looks like maybe you could build multiple dev boxes for different projects. So if I'm working on project A, I go spin up this dev box. If I'm working on project B, I go spin up this dev box. Project C, I go spin up this dev box. And it's in like this nice little Microsoft developer portal with all these certain VMs assigned based on projects that I can spin up. It talks about how it's all built on Windows 365, but then other images clearly show the Azure portal for setting these up. And then the next image will show like Windows 365. So I'm a little confused to your point of weirdness of where this sits. If it's Azure, if it's Windows 365, if it's some weird combination of the two. And someone explained to me what this gives me over Azure Virtual Desktop or Windows 365 with just a custom image in one of those.
Yeah. So I think what it's going to give you, and it's kind of maybe the missing piece there, is integration of development artifacts on a schedule. So one of the things that's called out, like if you go and watch the session around it, is being able to do things like, you know, let's say you have like a super long build tool chain to like get a new developer bootstrapped, and you're in a constantly iterating service. Like I could use like, heck, I'll use like Azure Storage as an example here, right? Like if I'm a developer in Azure Storage, I basically need to stand up an entire virtualized cluster of services, right, to stand everything up, because we're a multi-layered service with front ends, and we've got a partition layer and a stream layer and extents on the back end, and then all the services and configurations and things that run in between. And we have a metric ton of developers who are developing on the service. So there's constant rollouts and there's constant change and churn within the service. So for a new developer coming in, and even for existing developers, you're basically going in each day, like the very first thing that you're probably doing is doing a pull of the latest code and then a build. And then you're going to kind of see where everybody else's changes bake out against your changes. So for services that like this that can do artifact integration, you could say like overnight have the dev box rebuilt every night with the latest version of your code on it after it's already been committed to the repo for the day and it's all ready to go. But then my question becomes like, hey, this is just an artifact at that point. Like, I don't know why Windows 365 needs to be in the mix. Like, I'm really confused, like not so much where this sits with Windows 365, but where it sits with existing developer services that are kind of like this. Like, where does this sit with Codespaces and Azure Lab services and a couple other things that already exist out there? Like, does it just subsume them and eat them up? Do those continue to exist? Do they get new features? Does this get new features? I don't know. That's a weird one for me.
Got it. So you see the biggest advantage of these as having, being able to do like that nightly rebuild, pull, essentially rebase or re-level set your dev box every night versus having to do it when you first get in, start up your machine, hopefully saving you hour and a half every morning or something like that.
Theoretically, right? Or I want to have different environments for people to be able to rapidly test that are also based on kind of some type of ever-moving target for artifacts that are included within that tool chain.
I can see that. And being a dev, I think maybe I don't have an appreciation for how much time or what a headache that can be if I'm working on a dev box and having to go through that on a regular basis.
It can be pretty painful.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting service. And it's one, I don't know that I'll play with it a ton because I don't have a bunch of developers that I work with or in an environment where I have it. For me, Windows 365, AVD works just fine, but I might try to get my hands on it for a minute or two.
Just because you can.
Just because I can, exactly. In all of my free time.
You have free time? Where'd that come from?
No, I don't have free time. So one more. Do we have time for one more?
Hey, it's your show. Whatever you want.
No, it's not. It's our show. This is a team effort, Scott. Since we're on the development topic, we should talk about Power Apps. Did you know?
Okay. Did you know that if you just want to buy a WordPress site, it's super easy to do and you don't need Power Apps? Oh, did I say that out loud?
I thought we were going to talk about embedding teams in Power Apps, but we're talking about Power Apps pages.
Oh.
Or are we just going to make fun of Power Apps?
There's so much to talk about. Yeah, we can start wherever you want.
Or should we just save all of this for the next one? Because I have a feeling we could go longer with these topics.
You're into it. I think these were build announcements as well. Like there was a flurry of announcements around Power Platform in general, along with this kind of a bunch of like Azure data services and intelligent data framework and things like that. But yes, so there's a couple of things that are happening with Power Apps and what you can build into Power Apps and embed in Power Apps, and then capabilities that those Power Apps have as far as presentations back to users. So you want to talk about Teams first?
I'll talk about Teams. This was a short blurb. I need to go watch the on-demand session, and I want to talk about this because I want feedback from people on who's going to use this and what the rationale is for doing this. But one of the announcements that I'm still trying to wrap my head around is collaboration controls in Power Apps. At Build, they announced collaboration controls in Power Apps to let developers drag and drop Microsoft 365 collaboration features. So this is not just Teams, but it included Teams chats, meetings, files, tasks by Planner, so Planner, and more inside custom apps built with Power Apps. So now, I don't know, like I'm building some Power App and I want to embed a team chat within my Power App. I mean, like why would I want to do that? Maybe, I don't know if I'm building a service desk app and I want to embed the chat in the Power App. But I guess where I start going with this is why would I not put my Power App in Teams and have like an app that sits in a Teams team and I just have my chat in Teams? Versus building a Power App and putting chats in that, or meetings is another one. Like, why do I need a meeting in a Power App? I'm curious to see what people's rationale is. The one I can pull off of this that hopefully is going to be nice is files. I have absolutely had the need to link up files that are sitting in SharePoint in Teams. Creating a different app, I want to have files that are related to maybe a service desk ticket because you're building a super easy, simple service desk ticket in Power App, something like that. You want people to be able to attach files, access files. There is a bunch of hacky things you've had to do to work with files in Power Apps before. So hopefully this will help. I don't know. This one's coming mid-2022, so in the next couple of months. I'll go watch the session. This one is interesting. It feels like something I don't know that I need, but I might be wrong.
When you figure it out, I'm going to let you tell me all about it.
All right.
I didn't quite understand much of the value of that outside of things like maybe files and approvals, but chat, meetings, tasks, like I don't know. Maybe it leads to like quicker collaboration or something like that, because maybe you could be like more contextual about it. Like I don't know, make something off of my head. You're in a doctor's office, right? And like you have two doctors that need to talk to each other. So they go into the patient record and they can, you know, just easily spin up a team meeting, and then that has access to all the like files about that patient, like anything that's shareable through like EMR or something like that. I don't know. Maybe.
That was the one thing I had, but then is it associated with like that patient record in Power Apps? Like my thought there is, why not have the patient app in Teams as a tab? And then within that team, you're still having conversations and meetings and you just have the app right in Teams. I'm trying to figure out why you'd want to switch that around. And then it'll be interesting like to see where does that chat live, or does it provide some context in the chat that it was started from within Power Apps? And maybe I just need to go watch the session. But it looks like I can put Outlook in there too. I'm going to build a new email client in Power Apps with integrated embedded Outlook email.
It's not going to be a new email client. It's going to be the same Outlook client that you've always loved, just embedded. It's going to be a view within a view within a view.
But you know what you can do for all of you that have wanted email in Teams? Build a Power App, put it as a tab in Teams, and have that Power App's sole purpose be embedded email. And now you have email in Teams.
There you go. That's the way to do it.
All right. Anyways, we can move on from that one. But that one was an interesting one that I want to see a use case for. And I will go learn more about, because I have done Power Apps and curious to see what that entails. But the other one that you were referencing was Power App Pages.
No, Microsoft Power Pages. Make sure you Power get the branding pages. Right. It is the
Power
fifth.
Pages.
It's a new product. It's the fifth product in the Microsoft Power Platform family.
Not to be confused with Power App Portals, which were not a product, but still allowed you to build web pages and Power Apps.
Correct, because those were for building external portals. And then you could take those portals and customize them with pages, layouts, and content. But Power Pages, now that's not about portals. That's just about pages? I don't know.
This is one I saw the headline.
It goes beyond portals, right? And it's about building, I think, more generic websites. And the inner cynic in me kind of looks at it and just sees like WordPress or Squarespace kind of thing.
Use Visual Studio Code and Power Pages to code advanced capabilities. So you can do JavaScript, Liquid Template, Code Components. Describe to me, I still don't understand how this is different from Power, from portals, because it also says you can embed it with Dataverse and build like customer data. Is it missing like the whole login aspect to it where this is, well, but if you're pulling from Dataverse,
hey, for Dataverse, you'd have to be logged in.
Information you're pulling in.
Yeah. I don't know. Because it's supposed to support Dataverse, access. Which means it has, it has RBAC in it. It has native support for Azure Front Door, which is kind of interesting to kind of front it as a security and CDN solution. It's a little bit different than the existing kind of portal solutions. Like there's a whole new studio. Design studio that comes along with it. There's a bunch of pre-built templates for these things that are out there. Like you said, you can use Visual Studio Code. So if you wanted to take these things further and extend them, you can do that with JavaScript. There's a bunch of web APIs that are exposed for part of it. Like it's a really weird, like no code, low code, maybe like power usery kind of service that you could stand up pretty quickly. I think maybe then like portals, like some of the examples they gave, one of them was like an FAQ site. So maybe you have an FAQ site, like your Q&A is all stored in Dataverse and that's centered around products that you sell. And maybe you have like users who sign into a support site or something like that to be able to get going with it. Like that one makes sense. Customer self-service kinds of things. Like those kind of scenarios, I think kind of fit the bill. I don't know what it becomes if you don't use Dataverse and you don't need to log in. Like, then is it just WordPress or Squarespace or something like that?
Yeah. I don't know. I signed up for a trial. But the fact that I have to sign up for a trial also means that it's going to cost something. To me, that's the other big aspect of it is like, what is this thing? Ooh, yes, I build websites professionally. No, I don't build them professionally, but I want lots of options. Give it a name, Power Apps Portals, create a trial environment, selecting existing. Like the whole fact that, can I select environments that don't, I don't think I can. I think this requires Dataverse. So I'm going to assume that you're also going to have to be on some type of Power Apps plan then or something that supports Dataverse because it doesn't appear, I can't remember all the environments that I have in my Power Platform, but it doesn't appear that you can necessarily add these to an environment because this, it's created in the Power Platform. Like you select your environment that you have a Power App or Flow in or any of that. I'm curious what the price of this is going to be between the Dataverse backend and the actual cost for serving up the website.
Yeah. It's going to be a weird one. There is an FAQ that's out for kind of the service. It's all very light on details right now. So you can go watch the sessions from Build if you're interested. One of the things that's kind of available in the high-end documentation is a little bit of an FAQ where they talk about the difference between Power Apps portals and Power Pages. And this is Build as an evolution of Power Apps portals. So I wonder if it just kind of piggybacks and continues to extend that licensing, being that it's just supposed to be some natural evolution kind of thing.
So that would make more sense to me. If you told me that this was Power App Portals V2, and that once this goes live, Power App Portals are going to go away, are going to merge into Power Pages. Based on everything I've seen, that would make a whole lot more sense to me in my head in terms of what this is and where this is coming from. And that they essentially are like, Power App Portals make no sense because of they're really just building a web page, that Power Apps Pages make more sense, that it's the same licensing model.
all of that, and Power App Portals will die when Pages comes out of preview.
I'll put a link to some of the docs in the show notes just so everybody can kind of go and follow up on their own. The thing that I have not seen yet is pricing. Like, everything is just the free trials right now, so I think pricing might be a little bit up in the air and TBD.
Yeah, Power App Portals, I think, started at $500 a month for a portal. So I'm envisioning this is not... If you're going to compare this to like a WordPress site, don't expect this to compete with some of those other options. And if it's being fronted with Frontdoor and some of the other Azure services, it's not going to be like a few bucks to go stand up a small business website or something.
Yeah, probably not.
But that's, like you said, that's all just me speculating. So, all right, any other announcements from Build you had on your heart to talk about today, Scott?
No, I think that's about it. It's probably time to wrap up.
All right, sounds good. Well, I will let you go. Enjoy your weekend and consume more Build news and Build sessions. And I might go watch a few of these a little more that we talked about and learn all about dev boxes.
It'll give you something to do for the afternoon for sure. For those of you listening, if you have any questions after this episode and you'd like to ask for us to answer in a future episode, you can always reach out to us on Twitter. We're at MS Cloud IT Pro, or you can get at us through the MS Cloud IT Pro podcast members Discord, which you can access by signing up for a monthly membership. Monthly membership gives you access to Discord for chatting and participating in the show as it's recorded each week. You'll also get access to our To the Cloud streams on YouTube, where we dive into configuring and using features and services across Azure and Microsoft 365. If you're interested in learning more about membership, you can go to msclouditpro.com/membership. Thank you so much to everyone who has supported the show. And as always, thanks to our sponsor this week, IntelliJink.
If you enjoyed the podcast, go leave us a 5-star rating in iTunes. It helps to get the word out so more IT pros can learn about Office 365 and Azure. If you have any questions you want us to address on the show or feedback about the show, feel free to reach out via our website, Twitter, or Facebook. Thanks again for listening and have a great day.